Welcome to the Who Cares podcast, a podcast discussing aspects of social care, in particular domiciliary care, because we feel it is undervalued, it underpins the NHS, and it is our particular area of expertise. There will be no formal introductions as we plan to stay anonymous due to opinions we may give about certain, perhaps sensitive topics surrounding government policy, funding, CQC, but we'd also like, at some point, when we get our email address sorted, for people to write in, give their opinions, and have a platform where they can be anonymous or named and say what they feel is going wrong or right in a social care system. Today, we're going to be discussing what is domiciliary care. Domiciliary itself is hard to pronounce and hard to spell, but basically means care within the home. Who's entitled to it? How do you get it? How much does it cost? Who works? Etc., etc. Alongside me is my co-host, and it's hard to introduce someone and we're not going to give any names, but what do you want to be referred to as?
Her.
Her. Yes, not they.
No, her.
Her.
Thank you.
Or she.
Either way, whatever the word
I'm
is.
I'm a woman.
I'm a woman. I'm very proud to say I'm a woman. And so I would like to be referred to as female, if that's okay.
Female one.
Wait, female one's fine. Anyway, as long as I'm gender specified, I'm all good.
Gender specified.
Yes, thank you.
So you can be female one, and I can be male one.
I do prefer her, but either way.
Okay, her. Okay. So in your opinion, as the more care profession, of care professional of the two, what is domiciliary care?
Domiciliary care is, in a nutshell, community care. So care provided to people who live in their own homes, who for one or two or three reasons doesn't or can't live in a care home. They can't rely on family for support, and there isn't another suitable area for them to receive their care, whether that be community hospice or some form of other support network that is potentially available to people who need help.
Because a lot of time it's not the case that they can't necessarily, not that they can't live in a care home, it's also that they don't want to live in a care home because they're not ready yet.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're not ready, or the biggest difficulty is they years ago sort of ditched what would be called a residential home, so more of a social housing unit rather than, in theory, a care home is technically a nursing home. So people are there with nursing needs, like extensive medical needs or mental health needs, whereas a residential home, somebody would literally move in simply with a diagnosis of frailty or in desperate need of companionship, and they would live definitely heavily supported, but literally in one big group housing with other people under same circumstances, really. And there was that little stepping stone before having to go straight back, straight full into like a care facility, because a care home normally is, as I say, associated with fairly hefty nursing needs.
Mm. Well, it is kind of, you find the economic development of countries, so the lower economically developed countries care in the home because they can't really afford to do anything. So you have people having big families and sets of elderly parents living in the house. Then as the kind of countries develop economically, you have people cared for in a medical setting, and then as you get really wealthy countries or more wealthy countries, then you're going back into a home setting because they can afford to be cared for at home.
Yeah, which actually a lot of the time is people's preference for obvious reasons. People like to be at home. People actually, well, in my experience, most of the clients we provided care for or companies or settings I've worked for before would always opt for having their family be their care providers over anything. Usually the difficulty is in the culture in this country is that the families don't want to do that. They haven't got the room, they haven't got the separate space in life, whatever the reasons are, but it doesn't happen very often at all. So then people's second preference tends to be at home, looked after by another, which then in turn would be a domiciliary care agency.
Who are pretty much all private, when you talk about privatisation of the UK
yes.
health system.
Yeah, so domiciliary care agencies, at least 9.5 times out of 10, will be private healthcare companies, in theory.
Or charitable organisations,
or charitable organisations, but there's not tons of those, not really. Not some that are solely charitable and not also partly private owned or got some interconnection.
Because care delivered at home will be either by the family, by a private organisation, who will mainly do most of the care, local authority in-house care teams, district nurses, obviously little bits.
Very, very, very little bits. But what you're failing to mention there is local authority often fund the private agencies to provide the care for people at home. So people may well have care provided by a private company, but their funding for that care may well be supported by the local authority.
That's the fourth bullet point on this list.
But just as not to confuse the listeners, that those things often become the same thing anyway.
Yes.
Basically, the local authorities have one fairly small team that really was originally designed to do what they call reablement as a service. So somebody would come out of hospital, a local authority care team would go into Mr. Briggs and they would determine actually what support he needed at home once he's discharged from hospital. That template was only ever designed to last a maximum of 6 weeks and it could be as little as two. Then they would create Mr. Briggs needs this, they'd put it out to tender, an agency would bid for it and pick it up, and then an agency would actually take over Mr. Briggs' care. Local authorities over the past however many years have actually ended up being more of a private care agency themselves and actually hold on to certain packages, which was not their original design, nor is it as they describe themselves these days, but in our experience that's absolutely what they do. They even take on private clients, but originally they're supposed to assess basically,
and they usually charge over £20 an hour.
Yes,
taking on their own, you know, they do charge for it. It's not a charitable exercise by the local authorities by any means.
No, definitely not. But if and when they do as they are designed, it's actually a very efficient service. Just one not particularly preferred by the clients who experience them, because they're there to assess them. So they do the bare minimum. They're in and out as quick as they can. Clients obviously don't like feeling like that. I wouldn't like feeling like that myself. And so there's usually a bad rap for how they provide their care. But reablement is about that. It is the minimal. And that's the whole point of it. And then it will transfer to an agency that should be taking more time doing their own assessments, building on a proper care package.
There's a long way around question one, what is domiciliary care? Care in someone's own home.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's going to be a push towards more communal living things?
No.
Because I was listening to something, you're getting big developments being built and they've got all the bells and whistles enticing people in, pools, multi-sensory gyms, all sorts of other things where they can have these elderly communities. A bit American.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like you couldn't turn up with somebody with advanced dementia.
What's the difference between the UK in that scenario and America?
I'm assuming it's going to be financial.
It's not actually. It's more the willingness. So people in America who opt for these facilities, which are fantastic if they're done properly, tend to move into those facilities an awful lot earlier than people in the UK would opt to move themselves into somewhere. So people living in the UK will tend to wait until either they have no choice because they've been referred from a hospital stay to require care, or a family member's insisting on it, whereas the Americans tend to opt for it 5 years before they would actually need anything like that, which is a very sensible thing to do. They basically adapt to a different sort of community living.
But do you think there'll be a shift towards that? Housing crisis?
No,
we're on a housing crisis.
No.
Lots of elderly people sat on properties which have increased so high in value.
But there's not the space here. There's not the weather. There's not the things that make that appealing. You're
just thinking of the Florida retirement
homes. No, I'm not just thinking of the Florida retirement homes, but there's a lot to be said for those. You know, lots of things are outdoors. They have really big communities. There's tons more people there. So you move into this community and it is literally like moving into a county or half a county as it would be in the UK. It doesn't feel like you're moving into somewhere which is just for the elderly people to all go and shift off quietly doing their own thing. It's designed much more, I don't know what the word is, but it's designed a lot better and it doesn't feel like that. And then it actually promotes well-being and it promotes sort of longevity, because people then do go to the exercise classes, they do the bowling, they do go to the social club, and before they know it, they're living longer and healthier and more comfortable, and that pain in their back is gone, that social awkwardness is gone, and they're just adapted into this new situation, which the biggest issue is with people who we provide care for is like the self-neglect thing. So they become frightened, they become lonely, they become really, really, really pissed off with whatever, however life has landed them. And it's a downward spiral. They don't shave one day, they skip breakfast the next, they don't bother getting dressed the following week, etc., etc. And it's down, down and down until there's no backup. Whereas the facilities in America, because they are designed much more energetically...
Do you think there's more positive in general, though, by that?
Enormously, but it makes a massive difference. When you're looking at anybody for quality of life or life experience or how long life goes on for, your sort of mental state and approach to that has a huge, huge difference. I've nursed people years ago, and people getting diagnosed with lung cancer, for example. And there was one guy, I remember, he was in his 40s, and he came in happy as Larry, bad chest, etc., etc., ready for going home for some football match or something that weekend. He was told he had lung cancer midweek, and he died before that football match even was played. And nobody will ever convince me that that was anything to do with his medical state at that time. He hadn't even been given a prognosis. He wasn't stage four, he was stage two. He could have even been, you know, recoverable. But he just instantly, on the second he heard that news, and I nursed him myself, and he just was an entirely different person. And then you get other people who get diagnosed and, oh, well, I'm 74, I've done what I wanted to do, I'm fine, and you're nursing them 10 years later. It makes a huge difference. It doesn't always make the difference. We can't fight science, but it definitely has an impact. And that is the best thing about the American setup with their elderly communities, and it is the absolute worst thing that we have here in the UK.
So you're saying we should do it, but we can't.
Or we won't.
Or we won't.
Yeah. And it would be more difficult. And
because that would put a lot of private agencies out of work.
Well, if they didn't adapt or they didn't do a dual service, which most of the places in
America
did.
They would still need to provide some sort of care in that.
These people that live in these facilities all of a sudden can't walk without walking sticks again. It's not like a miracle healing
to Lords.
Yeah, basically, jump in this bath and you're healed. No, but there is an awful lot to be said for it, a huge amount. If you think about somebody's appetite, people eat so much better together. That's cultural. That goes back absolute centuries. It's the same thing.
Let's not get into a history lesson.
History's not my forte.
All right, so we've done what domiciliary care is. Mm-hmm. Providing a care service, which isn't necessarily always health. It could be, you've got a lot of kind of more companionship side because you've got your private contract. Social services won't necessarily provide anything for companionship, but private clients.
Nor any health needs specifically.
Yeah. Care within people's own home. And mm-hmm. that will give us a broad range. So that will be either on a private level, companionship and pet care.
Yeah.
Right through to...
End-of-life care.
End-of-life palliative care. Mm-hmm. In someone's own house.
Yes.
So, who's in... And we are specifically only talking about adult social care here.
Yes.
Nothing to do with children.
No, 18 years and over.
So, who's entitled to adult social care?
So any adult with a social care need. So that sounds like I'm answering your question with your question. But basically somebody who can't fulfil their own social needs. Now there's a heavy focus on the word social because anything that actually would class as medical or clinical is not covered under social care funding.
Well, yeah, okay, that was a bit of a rubbish question. So who's entitled to social care? You obviously have continuing health care, which is funding through the NHS.
Yeah, that would be, for example, somebody who's got a long-term medical condition, Parkinson's, for example. So they might get their social needs funded through their medical needs funding pool. So it depends.
Yeah.
Most people, sadly, who receive social care funding should absolutely be receiving non-social care funding through continuing healthcare because a lot of people have a medical need that is irreversible and does cause the restrictions on their social needs, but we'll talk about that in a different episode.
Yeah, there's a difficulty here because there's something to talk about between, but we've got who's entitled to it.
So basically,
and how much does it cost? Because those two things really, it's a case of everybody's entitled to it.
Well, potentially,
but what you're entitled to depends on what you can afford.
No, that's not right. So anybody who's got a social need is entitled to it. So let's use Mr. Briggs again. Let's say he can't actually...
Who isn't real, just so
No, he's not real. Mr. Briggs is, well, there's probably plenty of Mr. Briggs, but this Mr. Briggs is not real. Let's say he can't actually make his own lunch and he can't put his Ted stockings on. So that would class as a social need. So he would be eligible for social care funding if he didn't have his own substantial funds to pay for it himself through in full private means. Now, social care funding, it varies dramatically from county to county.
The general rule of thumb hovers around the £22,500 mark.
There or thereabouts. Some counties do include separate assets, though, and others don't.
Well, I was reading some of the local authorities' guidelines the other day, and A, they weren't very clear.
No, they're potentially not.
It didn't have a figure of 22.5, but you do read that a lot.
Yeah.
And it was all about that. If you receive this benefit, that benefit, does it include your pension? Does it include your pension? All these other things. Your contribution can't go above a certain amount. It really wasn't clear.
Yeah, it's not clear. Nor is it clear, even really, when you've had your funding assigned, how much, in way of percentage, you have been funded and how much you're funding yourself. So we've had clients over the years who basically receive 70% funding. And we've had other clients who receive about 15% funding. And the difficulty with that is they lose a lot of the autonomy over what's happening with the care because it's commissioned, contracted through the local authority, when in lots of instances, technically it's not. It's really financially actually heavy to the client, not to the council. But if they're involved in any way, shape or form, then it does fall under their contractual terms.
But often you get it. Who's entitled? Everyone's entitled to it, but if it's a social care need,
yeah,
and you have more than a certain amount of money, you can't really say you're entitled to care, but you're not entitled to funded care.
No.
So you're entitled to get your own care.
Entitled
to anything.
However, most local authorities will or should certainly support somebody to locate that care. They should educate them on how to choose the best care agency or the best care agency for them, who would be an option, who wouldn't be for their needs, etc., etc.
Okay, well, let's run into that. And I've kind of repeated myself a few times, so let's just go over that again. So everyone over the age of 18 is entitled to care of some sort.
Social care.
Social care. If you've got a certain amount of money in the bank or in assets, not including your house only gets taken into account if you have to go and live in a care home, as yeah. I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's entitled to care, but if you have assets or cash over a certain amount of money, you will have to fund part or all of it yourself.
All of it until you reach their benchmark. So yeah. Until you spend all your money, basically.
Mm-hmm. If you have either a long-term health condition or a very short-term prognosis, mm-hmm. you can get healthcare funding through continuing healthcare, clinical commissioning groups, basically the NHS.
Yes.
And then there are other funding streams. Obviously, you've got Macmillan, you've got Marie Curie, you've got
local charities.
And they are all, again, though, that's usually for palliative, end of life, short term mm-hmm. prognosis.
Or exceptional circumstances.
Or exceptional circumstances.
With the local charities. Yeah.
So everyone's entitled, but there are certain barriers of entry, shall we say.
There's barriers of entry, but the biggest issue there is there's not open information out there about how people can access it, because that's the most common thing we get when we take on new clients. People had no idea the service existed, they had no idea they're entitled to it, they had no idea they could access it, etc., etc. And that's the biggest shame.
Okay, so running on to the next topic quite seamlessly,
mm.
almost professional. How do you get it? Let's say I need care right now.
Yeah.
I can't do anything for myself.
Well, the easiest thing to do is ring your GP.
And I've got no money.
Well, that makes things more straightforward in lots of ways. You ring your GP, you explain what you need help with, they contact social services on your behalf, ideally. What they're likely to do is give you the number.
GP.
Yeah, they're likely to give you the number for your local authority to ring up yourself, and you can basically self-refer, or your GP refers you. That process is fairly quick because they have to respond to anybody that gets referred. Then it basically gets handed over to a social worker or somebody that works within a social work team. They will then be in touch with you, ask you why you think you need this help, or your GP. And they will come and do a physical assessment of you and your environment.
As long as they're not doing anything else like walking the dog, seeing as they're all working from home now.
Yeah, or, you know, out at the park with the kiddies or whatever they've been doing throughout the pandemic, not answering their phones or emails. And then they will come and do that practical assessment, and if they deem you in need...
Which I am.
Which you are, but it's not an easy thing some of the time to be able to demonstrate you are. And that's not me saying, you know, like those bumper stickers, not every disability is visible sort of thing. But not every need can be demonstrated as needed, if I'm making sense. It's a very personal thing, needing care. And needing care with certain provisions, you can't always demonstrate that to you. The person that's there to assess you at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon, you need the help at 7 o'clock on every morning of the week, as an example. But if he or she deems you in need, they then... contact their brokerage team within the social services, and then out comes a package for tender describing what you as Mr. Briggs requires. So it might say morning visit to support, breakfast and personal care. 30 minutes will be commissioned. You need to respond to this inquiry by tomorrow at midday.
So I ring my GP.
Yeah.
They either ring on my behalf or I ring... this social care team.
Yep.
They assess me.
Mm-hmm.
They assess my finances.
Mm-hmm.
They then take what I need, as in a call in the morning, call in the lunch, call in the evening.
Yeah.
They send it out via a brokerage team to be picked up by
a number of private healthcare agencies
in my local area.
Yeah. And we get an opportunity to write about what we can offer, how we would provide it, how good we are, what our continuity plans are, etc., etc. And then you, as the client, should be given the informed choice. Yes, should, doesn't always happen. Should be given any response that comes in within that deadline, so you can choose which agency you feel is more suitable to your needs or to your preference. A lot of the time, and certainly recently, which the excuse is always going to be COVID, and it's going to be interesting how long that excuse lasts for, is there isn't the time to do that. So Mr. Briggs would just get the first care agency that responded.
Well, it isn't necessarily the capacity either.
No, there's not necessarily the capacity, but the worst thing is there's not even, you're not even given the time to see if anybody else comes in for that. It's difficult because... whichever agency has replied, say Mr. Briggs's care requirement says he wants a morning call at 8 o'clock. The agency that's responded might say they can't come till 10:45, and he's requested 8 a.m.
Yeah, I need eight.
Of course you do. Everybody needs, you know, an early morning call. Anyway, some people do, some people don't, but lots of people request it. The point is, whichever should or shouldn't have it, the issue is that choice is automatically presently, and it had been in the past also, been removed from you as Mr. Briggs because they're ignoring your request for 8 o'clock. The brokerage team, they're not seeing if anybody else can actually meet a better time. So rather than ringing you at midday the next day and saying, well, one agency can do 10:45, another can do 9:30, but there's some information on both agencies that you should consider before you make your choice. That's the bit that doesn't happen anymore. It's just, these guys have responded, they will do.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And so you just have to hope that, you know, the person that's responded has got your best interest at heart and can provide the care that you need.
And that's just the social care.
Mm-hmm.
What you notice on the continuing healthcare CCG NHS funded care calls is that A,
dire.
No times on any of the calls anyway. No. They need a morning call, they need a lunch call, they need an evening call. And that seems to be geared with, well, they need this care, they're not paying for it, so this is what they're getting.
Yeah, there's and no generally, specific needs on there.
As much as there potentially are policies and regulations about there should be choice, often the message that comes back through is, well, you haven't been successful this tender as an agency because so-and-so replied first. So you know for a fact that someone sat there receiving the response from the agency saying, we can do X, Y, and Z. They're taking it and then telling the patient or the client, this is the package of care you're having, and there's no real choice involved there at all.
No.
And that's from a lot of experience.
Yeah, enormously. And the saddest thing about that, which is why it needs its own episode, is it's normally people who are in drastic need of very, very urgent and very, very thorough, intense care. And it's normally for people that have never had any introduction to care at all. These are people that need it immediately because something very severe has happened within their life. It's not like they've been in the care sector before and understand any of it. And it's not just the client, that includes their family and everybody associated with that provision. It's a really, really undignified and uncaring way to prescribe care. But that really needs its own.
But if I, let's say I'm terminally ill,
yes,
or I have a long-term health condition, how do I get care then?
That only can be done through your GP. It can't be done any other way, shape or form. And they will send a community nurse to do a separate assessment on you before it's even referred to the continuing healthcare. There's an 8-week waiting list for that assessment to be done currently in our local authority. And then it often gets sent to panel there at the CHT. When it reaches CHT. 8 weeks before the community nursing team can even complete the assessment on you. They have an 8-week window.
Well, some of these people are 2-week fast tracks, as in, yeah, not expected.
Anyone that's on a fast track normally get their standard template package, so 4 calls a day with 2 carers without any other information being shared on either side, which is ridiculous in itself. They go on about how the NHS is in tons of debt. It would be a good way to start. It's not just chucking money out for nothing. But any that, say, is somebody with Parkinson's who's living at home alone and needs critical timing with their med support and feeding, for example, they have to wait up to eight weeks for the community team to come out to even complete the assessment. Then it gets sent to the continuing healthcare. Then it gets sent to a panel. Then they let you know if they think you're entitled to it or not. And there's no one else that helps with that. So local authorities, lots of people harp on about how shite they are. And there are lots of shite things. But there's also some really good hearts in the right place kind of thing with most of them, really, if you're patient and you're honest as a manager of a company like the one we work in. It often comes from a good place, so people are going to pay attention to things and they're going to try their best, but it just doesn't happen in continuing healthcare. Social services, the local authority, would at least ask the name of the person you're talking about.
No, you're talking, when you're dealing with CHC, whatever you bloody call them, the NHS.
They're not interested.
NHS care.
They're not interested.
They just say, what's their number? You're dealing with numbers and dates of birth. You're not dealing with people.
They claim it's because it's GDPR, but it's not. It's the most impersonal thing on the planet. And it's often the time of somebody's life that really should be as intimate and personal as it possibly could be.
Yeah, no, to be fair to social services, you know, oftentimes even when they're getting frustrating, if you hit them with a stick, they often respond.
Yeah, you remind them why.
Not necessarily those at the top with their two personal assistants that no one's ever seen and they're on exorbitant salaries. But
and on annual leave the vast majority of the time, including the PAs. But no, the people that generally, what I would call the middle management, the people that actually we get to deal with, really want the same things. They just don't have the ability to carry it through. But they do want the same things. And you can say that, definitely. Whereas continuing healthcare really couldn't give a shit. Or that's certainly been our impression. And that's not been recently.
In general.
To do with COVID. In general. And it's been for the entirety of us ever contracting with them. And in my personal experience, that's 10 years this October. And there's never once been anybody I've worked with under that contract who's given a monkey's. Literally not one. And really embarrassingly, I think that's often because it is mainly assessed and run by nurses, by qualified nurses. And again, in my experience, you get some absolute godly nurses that are literally have been sent from a different planet, and they're the best people to be doing the jobs they're doing. But then the other fraction that you get are really cold and really uncaring, and nobody knows why they came into nursing, and often in positions within continuing healthcare, because on the level we're dealing with it is people who are band sevens, band eights. It's basically management, and it's not the right aspect of nursing. And that probably sounds like a very pompous thing to say, but I think when you're on both sides of the fence, it's really impossible to ignore that seems to be a correlating factor.
You tend to move up or out for a reason.
Yes, my experience in the NHS, that was definitely that.
And in any local authority or government organisation, it is famously hard to get rid of people.
Mm. So. No, well, in the NHS it is. They don't. I was involved in a process once, and it was literally impossible.
Well, we can have a whole episode on different types of nurses working in hospitals and such things.
Who to avoid?
Yeah. Oh no, I still hope just I never receive any care.
Just don't think about it. What's the next thing you want to
do? We've done what is care, we've done who is entitled to it, which based on 22,000 is nobody.
Mm-hmm.
How you get it.
You have to ask for help.
You have to ask for help.
Basically.
And how much does it cost? In terms of how you get it though, what about if you knew, let's say my friend Gerald down the road has an excellent set of carers coming in. Mm-hmm. Could I ring an agency directly?
Yeah, of course you could.
Will they ring on my behalf or will they just do the same as the GP and tell me to?
No, you'd have to do it yourself. They can't refer you. You could ring and say, I'm interested in having your services. I need what Gerald needs. And they would say, well, that's lovely. Call us back as soon as you know how you're funding that care. And that sounds a very cold way of describing it. I don't mean it like that, because the funding comes down to a contract. So it's like, well, if this is going to go through the local authority, then we need to have the contract from the local authority.
Plus it's a local authority that will do the initial assessment. Yeah. So if potentially, so it's a full on, if it's a fully funded contract, as in they've found the money under my bed and mm-hmm. therefore know I can pay for it myself,
mm-hmm.
the agency itself will do the assessment, not the local authority.
Yeah, so the agency either way do their own assessment or should.
Should.
Regardless of who's done an assessment beforehand, be that continuing healthcare or the local authority, every client that receives care in the United Kingdom should have a separate care plan yeah. completed by the care agency.
Whereas if they don't find the money under my bed and social services are funding it, then the agency will need to know what that package of care is going to be, which ultimately can only come from the local authority when they kick themselves into gear.
Yeah, when they decide what's what. One thing that the agency will never know is how much the client has been assessed for in way of funding. So you said about assessing the client, they do two assessments. So they do a practical assessment, which I've touched on before, about the actual person, but they do a financial assessment where they determine how much they think they should be funding and how much they think the client should be funding. And that does often come on the level of need as well. So let's say you haven't got the money and they will fund it, it does also depend how much they still make you fund yourself. So people don't get a blanket. If the local authority is funding, that doesn't mean that the client pays nothing. They certainly pay something. And it ranges from about 15% contribution right up the way to about 80-90%. So each individual is assessed entirely differently, is my point.
And depends on what they think I need.
So if I just need
get up, get dressed and go to bed, and maybe a shower call a week.
Yeah.
Because I only need to wash once a week, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I need help at lunch. If they don't agree, I'll have to fund that lunch call.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. When that's regardless of whether I have the money or not, it's a case of, well, you don't need it.
Yes, which was what, as I said earlier, is the difficulty is they come to assess you at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon. They're not actually assessing you when you need the help or the support. They don't.
It's not like a BMW 24-hour road test.
No. They don't
come
even
and live with you for 24 hours.
No, but all jokes aside, you know, they don't go for the key times. Like if we go to assess a client, we will go normally in the morning so we can see if somebody's actually presentable when we get there, if they claim that they are. If they're saying they don't need help with meals or drinks, you know, we ask them to make a drink. It's sensible things like that, which I'm sure some social teams will advocate they do, but social work hours don't accommodate.
Try not to ask where the spoons are.
Yeah, that doesn't end well with all clients.
Mm. Okay. So now I've got my package of care, same as Gerald.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to come and see me? Who works in social care? For a care agency, in domiciliary care?
That's a very interesting question with a very lengthy answer. But in summary, in a good care agency, the people that work in the agency will be kind, they'll be caring, they'll be really interested in what they do, and they just want to be out there to make somebody's life better, and they'll do anything they can to help. They are normally skilled via their agencies, so their qualifications are normally provided within the care agency. So they might have come from another unskilled sector or something into care, which is a skilled sector. It just isn't recognised for as one, but it is. You have to be able to give people medication. It's a skilled sector, absolutely. And I know for a fact that not every person on this planet could go and wash somebody in a dignified way. So it's certainly skilled. But they get their training within their agency for the specifics that they need. And they're normally really, really, really lovely people. They normally have somebody else they need to care for as well. So the agencies that they work for has to be a really strong and flexible but strict management team, because you have to accommodate for all sorts of people and all sorts of people's needs. People that care, obviously care everywhere, not just in one place. And they're great people. You can get some carers who think it's quick money, that they're in, they're out, it's easy, they just have to make somebody a sandwich and they're off.
Well, yes, initially there was a lot of normally or a good agency.
Yeah.
But realistically.
Realistically, there's an awful lot of bad agencies out there and they run their staff badly. But again, this will be another episode, because I very, very, very strongly believe that most bad carers are bad carers because they work for bad companies. I think most people who even are interested in working in care, like the local authority, come from the right place. They're coming at it from the right angle. They just need the right management.
Although that goes, if you reverse that into, or turn that into, yeah, the nursing element, you can't necessarily say that bad nurses only work in bad hospitals.
There's aspects of control in nursing. You have so much control. It comes down to that in nursing. It's a very, I don't know what the word is, but it's, you have to trust the person that's nursing you implicitly. They're responsible for lots of complex things. You need to trust a nurse as much as you trust your doctor. And that's probably another misconception that people generally make. But that's a separate point.
So the people coming to visit me could be anybody.
They
could have worked at Tesco's the week before.
Yes. They could have never worked.
They could have never worked.
They could have been a nurse for 40 years and
they could
then
be 18.
In retirement. They could be 18.
They could be 73.
They could. But if they come from an agency that really cares about what they do, then you can rest assured that 9.5 times out of 10, that'd be fantastic. But generally, it's a very, very, very varied workforce. Very, very varied.
And who oversees them?
So the management of the company. So normally in a safely run agency, you'll have an active management, because the management, in theory, are responsible for everything. So you're responsible for every single carer that's out at work, for every minute of the day you provide the care, whether you're in the office, you're out on care yourself, or if you're in Sainsbury's on a Saturday morning with your children, you're still as accountable. So it needs to be taken very, very seriously. And if it is, then there's not really any issue, because that manager or that team of managers aren't ever going to want to compromise anything, because it's too important.
So when I call the office,
yes,
because so and so's been brilliant and I want to compliment them,
mm-hmm.
Who might I speak to? There's going to
be, you can assume anybody in the office, but you'd normally get care coordinators, somebody that schedules the care. You might get assistant management teams. You have your senior management team, possibly admin staff, and obviously managing directors
in the office.
Well, I'd like to think so. Certainly for some part of the day, yeah.
And a registered manager.
And a registered manager, which is in your senior management team. So you're always going to have somebody that is formally registered with CQC. I say always, not all agencies are registered with CQC. In a registered agency, you'll always have somebody with a formal registration with the Care Quality Commission, which regulates care. But in another episode, we'll discuss that, because that's sort of a voluntary thing. The government don't regulate that. They don't fund it. So you could argue that the government don't care about what standard of care people are receiving.
The other argument could be that they wanted somebody who wasn't under the watch of the government and was therefore completely impartial.
But they have tabs on most of the things, so why not provision? They're so far up the NHS's arse, but they couldn't give a monkey's what happens on community care, which underpins the NHS.
But obviously they've devolved all that responsibility, or a lot of that responsibility, over to the CQC so that they can monitor it.
Yeah, but the CQC themselves aren't regulated.
They've got to be to a certain degree.
To a certain degree, but not formally. Yet most of the provision provided in England is regulated by a company or a body that isn't really overseen formally by anybody else.
Well, they can't be overseen that closely, otherwise it'd be...
Well, they wouldn't be these struggles.
Brought to rights over the COVID debacle.
Oh, yeah, of course they would. It's disastrous.
So the adult care system is overseen by...
By basically a body...
Public Health England, obviously.
It's not overseen by Public Health England. It's advice. You receive advice and guidance from Public Health
England. A lot of your policies, your guidance is direct from central government.
Yeah. Yeah, but it always trickles down to community care last.
Mm.
So you're sort of the last to receive the information and the advice. So you have to be one step ahead of everybody all the time to run anything efficiently. But generally... You've got your local authority, if you contract with your local authority, who oversees certain things, but most of the time they'll say, well, that's your decision, that's your company.
Work within their contract.
Yeah. All we can advise is this. And then you've got the CQC, Care Quality Commission, who are our regulating body. But they, like I say, aren't formulated by anybody else. And maybe it's fine that they're not, but anything else where there's sort of impact the quality of life or continuation of life is overseen by some other, and it's not.
So there's this scenario for you then. So
and we have to pay for it. We fund the CQC. So we don't only have to be registered with the CQC, we have to pay to keep them existing to tell us if we're doing the right job or not. But nobody actually really, in the very, very top scheme of things, that harps on about all these problems in the country with community care actually have a hand in, if that's it.
Depending on the size of your agency, you can be easily looking at £8,000-£9,000 a year or more.
Yeah, easily.
Per agency.
Yeah.
So, scenario. Boris, jolly old Boris, is telling you to do one thing.
Yes.
The local authority contract's telling you to do another.
Mm-hmm.
And CQC contracts both of those. Which one do you follow?
Got my honest opinion. Whatever I thought was the most sensible thing to do. I wouldn't necessarily do what any of them said.
And then risk assess.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Boris wouldn't have a monkeys. CQC would be going off what somebody else had assumed to be the right thing to do, and they govern far too many people, so they wouldn't know specifically. And not specifically to our agency. And local authority do their best they can, but basically they sort of regurgitate what CQC and Public Health England, so a bit of Boris and a bit of CQC, would say together. And often there's no clarity in that. They also like to communicate those things over the phone, not in writing. So there's no evidence that you've been even guided in the first place.
Although they record them, so they have it in case they ever need it.
Yeah, possibly.
if you ever say anything wrong.
But it comes down to really your own integrity and... bit of guesswork, bit of logic, bit of best intentions.
Famous guesswork and logic.
It is famous.
So that's probably pretty much everything for episode one. We've gone through what is domiciliary care. So domiciliary care is care delivered from companionship through to end of life in somebody's own home. So they're not in a care home, they're not in a hospital, they're not in a respite facility. It is their own house, rented or privately owned. Anyone's entitled to it over the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
But how much you get and what you get all comes down to either what the local authority or the NHS will pay for and what you're able to or willing to, in some cases, whether it's you personally or your family are willing to pay,
mm-hmm.
And powers of attorney and such things, which we'll discuss in other episodes. How you get it, call your GP. Either call an agency directly and they'll be able to, if they're a good agency, they'll at least be able to give you some advice about who to call and what questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if someone's being difficult about an assessment or dragging their feet, they'll probably also be able to give you some advice, or may be able to put an email through or a phone call, not necessarily on your behalf, but certainly be able to say, this person's been in contact and they're having trouble getting help.
Yes.
A caring agency would do that.
Mm-hmm. A responsive agency.
How much does it cost? Now, one thing we didn't say in terms of private rates, but that's going to be different depending on where you are in the country.
What you want, different agencies charge different things for different times of the day, different days of the week, etc., etc. So it's
and have different add-ons. So I think the UK Home Care Association had something a few years ago that said something about between £23 and £30 or £32 an hour. But again, that's from north of England to London,
mm-hmm.
and it might be £23 an hour, but they also might charge you travel on top per visit. They might give you admin charges and anything else. And
basically, it's a grey area, but it's not cheap.
And social care don't actually cover anything for medication, so an agency would be well within their rights to charge you anything to do with medication, whether that's ordering, managing, or administering.
Yeah, because you're not covered contractually. That's all on the agency's own back.
Yeah. Who works in it? Again, anybody. But it's usually, typically you find carers are drawn to care. They often have either been in care themselves, have cared for somebody themselves, some sort of, not trauma or tragedy, but sometimes you can often find, I don't want to say broken people, but
people who need help healing and giving back.
Compulsion of giving back, oftentimes.
Yeah, definitely.
Sometimes people, it's just their calling, and mm-hmm. that's they're brilliant at it. People are natural born nurses and caring people, but a lot of carers you will find have some need to give back or want to give back. Who manages it? So in terms of when you call the office or who a care agency is run by, you will find there are care coordinators who schedule the care, admin staff, compliance staff who help with writing the policies and making sure that the agency is up to date, a registered manager who oversees a certain area, branch or number of branches, and who regulates it. So your policies come down through central government, Public Health England, CQC, a local authority contract, or an NHS care contract.
Yes.
Do you think that just that kind of broadly covers what domiciliary care is and what someone could expect in terms of if they need it within the next few years for a relative or for themselves?
Yes. The advice I would give to everybody, though, is sort of live a bit American and don't wait until it's absolutely vital. Start way before. Introduce yourself to care early. Get used to what you're comfortable with, what you're not, what you can manage with, what you can manage without, etc., etc.
And again, in terms of getting yourself used to care and the general area, you could subscribe to this podcast by whatever button is on the phone or device you're listening to, so you can be up to date with our second episode, third episode, fourth episode, and however many of these we might produce, so you can immerse yourself in knowledge of the sector before you necessarily need it.
That's what we're going to try and do anyway. Educate people, because people don't know enough about it, and it is hugely required.
It'd be nice if we can get it to a stage as well where we can potentially hold certain things to rights, even if it is just on this platform and our opinions with the people who decide to listen to us. So let's say Boris does something completely stupid.
Every day of the week, that's what we do. Certainly what I do is try and do everything we can for the people that need the support, and that's not just within the people. It within our local authority.
Like announce billions of funding for a hard-hitting headline only to then share it with the NHS, even though it was supposed to be specifically for social care.
Or care homes and not community care. So, because that's what's happened right the way through the pandemic.
We don't want to end on a bad note, though. What are the second and third episodes going to be about? Or do you think? What do you think we should talk about next, apart from different types of nurses and other inflammatory topics?
I think definitely the next episode is going to have a focus on good care or bad care and how to tell between the two. Friends of mine or relatives that ring anybody are normally entirely clueless, because who wouldn't be when they've not experienced or needed to experience care before? And it's a total minefield if you don't know what you're looking for. So the next episode is definitely going to be how to tell if it's good or it's bad. And the one after that is do they care? So the focus is going to be about the carers themselves and how that can appear careless, but often it's not the carers, it's the companies or the conditions they're having to work under. Carers themselves and the individual get such negative media for all the things they do wrong, but nobody presses the point of why they're having to do things as they do in some circumstances.
Okay. So in the good care and bad care, there could probably be some like red flags as well, as in this could be sign of a wider issue.
Yes, definitely. We will cover as many red flags as possible. And basically just the really easy signpost for what to look for is the green. You only need a couple and you're on the right tracks. But it's valuable to have that information.
Okay. Well, I'm going to wrap us up again with a bit more begging. So this was the Who Cares podcast. This was her.
As she chooses to, you know.
And him. Anonymous to the end. And I do ask you to subscribe, leave us a comment, leave us a review. We are in the description. There should be, by now, a email address which you can send us your thoughts, send us your experiences of care, send us any worries you might have, any questions you might have. Questions are always good. If for no other reason, it will fluff out the content if we struggle for topics, but I don't think we ever will. But for now, hopefully we can have you listening with us again in episode 2.